It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, the governor is signing into law today three bills strengthening domestic violence laws in Wisconsin.
The bills were passed by the legislature earlier in the season, and they deal with issues relating to restraining orders, firearms, and stalking.
Joining us now to talk more about these bills is Patty Seeger, executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's take a look at these bills, starting with one that involves domestic violence suspects with guns. This is known as the SAFE Act. What would this one do?
Well, we call it SAFE Act. It's an acronym for Stopping Abuse Fatalities Through Enforcement. And it really just creates an implementation method for a very long-standing law. In Wisconsin, since the early 90s, our law forbid domestic abusers, people who were the subject of a restraining order, from possessing firearms during the term of the restraining order. Yet there was never any implementation procedure written into law that told law enforcement and the courts how to ensure that the surrender of firearms actually occurred. So what we have found is that for many years, most counties in Wisconsin did not actively enforce the surrender requirement. And this bill we introduced, we worked to have introduced several times. This year it passed. It's very significant because we know that guns and domestic violence don't mix, that when guns are present in an abusive relationship, it simply makes an abuser more dangerous and more lethal, and it's more likely that a victim will be killed.
So, Patty, does this bill then create the mechanism for the firearm to be formally surrendered each time?
Yes, it creates a mechanism for the firearm to be surrendered. It also, one of the provisions in current law is that the respondent to an order could give the firearm to a third party. It now requires that the third party come to the court, and the court will educate that person and give them an understanding of the responsibility of holding guns for another person, and that if they violate by giving the gun to the respondent to that order, that they themselves become subject to being charged with a crime.
And another bill takes a look at the issue of stalking. What does that bill address?
Well, it actually adds stalking into the definition of domestic abuse. Wisconsin has existing definition of domestic abuse in our state law, which does not include stalking, yet we know stalking is present many of the times when domestic violence is occurring. We also know that from our more than 10 years of studying homicides in Wisconsin, that lethality increases exponentially when the abuser is stalking the victim. So we have asked that stalking be added into the definition of domestic abuse, and that was really key and extremely important, so that now it becomes one of those acts that law enforcement and prosecutors and courts can consider and take seriously when arresting and charging and prosecuting for domestic abuse.
So what happened before this bill? If an abuse victim was being stalked, they could, I guess, get a restraining order. Was there anything else that happened?
Well, there is a separate charge of stalking that can happen. And that's a felony in Wisconsin. It's a little bit difficult to prove, and it's not just it's everybody has acknowledged that it can be one of the elements of domestic abuse, but it's just never fallen in our definition. So now when someone seeks a restraining order, for example, if they are being stalked but haven't been physically harmed, but the person is obsessed with them and following them, calling them repeatedly, and that person can show that they're being stalked, that can be the basis for getting a restraining order. Currently, there's not stalking in our restraining order law.
Okay, let's move on to the third bill. This one standardizes some procedural things for police, gives more tools. Walk us through that one.
Sure. The final bill, Senate Bill 160, ensures that law enforcement officers refer victims of domestic abuse to services after the law enforcement officers respond to the scene of a domestic violence incident. Many officers do refer victims to services, but there's no requirement, and many officers don't refer victims. What we know is that connecting victims with services is absolutely critical and can be one of the most significant steps a victim can take to improve his or her safety. And that, you know, victims become very isolated, and many of them aren't even aware that services exist in their community. So when they get a referral from the police officer that tells them that there's a free, confidential, 24/7 service available in their community that can help offer them support and services so that they can make choices about their safety, it's absolutely critical.
Patty, what kinds of services are available across Wisconsin for victims of domestic violence?
In Wisconsin, we have 72 counties and 11 tribes, and there are domestic violence services available in all of those counties and tribes. We have about 48 shelters, and shelters provide emergency physical safety in a building that's owned and operated by the program. But there are many, many outreach services as well. There are staff who are trained and prepared to help victims with legal issues, help them assist them, and provide them information about restraining orders, how to obtain them, how to file a police report. Programs also offer support groups, individual counseling, services for their children, for teens, and they do a lot of public education in all of their communities.
Can you give us a sense of how big a problem domestic violence is here in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, in Wisconsin and nationally and internationally, it's believed that 1 in 3 women are victims of domestic violence. 1 in 7 men are victims. In Wisconsin, we know that local domestic violence programs serve more than 40,000 women, children, and men annually. We know that there are about 30,000 or so arrests and referrals through law enforcement and to prosecutors' offices for domestic violence in the state. Those numbers don't necessarily correspond with each other. Some victims may seek the assistance of a shelter or a domestic abuse program without ever seeking the assistance of law enforcement. So we know that the numbers are large. We know that we also turn away a lot of people. In a single day survey where we did a 24-hour unduplicated count of services in Wisconsin last September, programs turned away more than 270 victims in a single day and served 1,700 victims in a single day. So we know that, and that's just one single day, you know, multiply that by 365. So we know that there are a lot of people coming forward. We know that there's a high demand for services, and we know that we don't have enough funding to serve everybody.
How are you feeling today with the passage of these three laws? Are you feeling good, or is it still a lot of work to be done?
There's a lot of work to be done, but it's hard to not feel positive when three extraordinary bills are passing, being signed all in one day. We're especially proud of the SAFE Act, which is a bill we worked on for a very long time. It has the support of the law enforcement community and the prosecution community and obviously the victim advocacy community, and many victims are here today, victims of shootings themselves, victims of parents who've lost their children to domestic violence, homicide by gun, in these exact circumstances where the abuser had a restraining order and there was failure to recover the firearms. So it feels like a huge success, and we're really very proud and thankful to the legislators who authored it and thankful to the governor for signing it.
And now that these have passed, what's next on the agenda? What else would you like to see passed next?
Oh, you know, we're regrouping and thinking about what's next for next year. I think we really want to pursue some of the some legislation that helps to address some of the economic impacts that violence has on victims' lives and see if we can do something to help improve that situation for them.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for covering.
We've been talking with Patty Seeger, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She joined us to talk about the domestic violence bills being signed by Governor Walker today.
With fall elections a little over 6 months away, it's that time of the election cycle when the attention of lawmakers starts to turn from legislation to politics.
Members of Congress are on recess for 2 weeks. Many of them are in their home districts raising money and talking about hot topics like Obamacare.
The word on the street is that the Senate is well within reach for Republicans, and money is pouring in on both sides.
USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time for an inside look at Congress. And this week we'll take a look at some of the most hotly contested congressional seats this fall. Paul, thanks for being back with us.
Always a pleasure, Veronica. How you doing?
Doing pretty well. So it sounds like members are in recess. They're often back in their home districts. So what do you think the message is as they go back to their home states?
Well, I believe part of the message is going to be about Obamacare. The Democrats want to go back to their states and tout some of the success. They want to point out that more than 7 million people have signed up for the Health Care Act. Keep in mind, there's also some private sign-ups that are outside of the federal exchanges. And basically, they're going to try and make the point that, hey, this thing is actually starting to take hold and starting to work. Republicans are going to say just the opposite. They're going to make Obamacare, again, part of the conversation and say it's a government takeover of your health care. They promise you can keep your doctor and you can't. Prices are going to be going up. And it's bad, 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 and we should fix it.
So are Democrats actually turning to embrace Obamacare at least a little bit? Because prior to this, the message had been sort of distance yourself. It doesn't seem like it's working out that well, and we want to get reelected.
Well, the whole theory has been that they would run away from the law, but I'm not sure that's actually all that true. And I think if it begins to achieve what the intended outcome was, which is people who did not have insurance getting insured, insurance becoming more predictable and more accessible to people who have pre-existing conditions or otherwise are in need, then I think Democrats will be proud to stand up next to it and say, hey, look, we are in the process of fixing the system. I think what you will see is on all fronts, the Democrats will be saying it still needs repair, that it's not a perfect law and it needs to be fixed. But I would not be surprised to see Democrats claiming some success and some pride in their ownership of the law.
So what happens to the Republican message then if Democrats start to embrace Obamacare? Do Republicans continue to attack on that front, or do they change tack?
No, totally.
They're all in.
Yeah, no, the Republicans, because a couple of things are going to happen. We believe that you'll see people having the insurance rates starting to kick in this summer that are slightly more expensive and possibly significantly more expensive than their prior insurance. The Republicans think that sticker shock is going to be a very painful thing. And they're going to, again, say it's the Democrats' fault, it's the Obamacare law fault, this is a bad law. And for a lot of Republicans, the issue is not even the sort of on-the-ground impact of the law. The real implication for them is overreach of government. And you know, the Democrats misnamed this law from the beginning. When they named it the Affordable Care Act, it's not a very catchy name. And so the name that stuck instead, and the Democrats themselves have begun to embrace, is Obamacare. That makes it easy for Republicans to paint as part of Obama's big government outreach, overreach, some sort of imperial presidency. It will be very much part of the message.
Interesting to talk about that as a branding mistake, but
we can
talk about that another time. I want to get to the Senate, because the Senate is hanging in the balance right now. Democrats under the gun to keep it, Republicans looking to take it over. Tell us what's at stake here.
Well, what's at stake is the control of the agenda in Congress. There are the Republicans need to take a net six seats from the Democrats to gain the majority again and control both the House and the Senate. And there are about a dozen races that are very, very close, and the Republicans are clearly within reach if they're able to win some key races, particularly in places like Louisiana, where Democrat Mary Landrieu is running for re-election. Mark Pryor, next door in Arkansas, another Democrat running for re-election. These are states that voted overwhelmingly Republican in the presidential campaign, but they have Democratic senators, both of whom, by the way, voted for the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. and both of whom are now very much on the defensive. If the Republicans can take those seats and a few more, they could take control of the Senate.
So how vulnerable are these seats? You mentioned Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and Mark Pryor from Arkansas. Let's take a look at those as sort of bellwethers. Where do they stand?
Well, they're neck and neck. Particularly in the Arkansas seat, the Republicans have a really solid candidate they're really happy with. They have a guy named Tom Cotton. He's a military veteran. He's a young guy. He's been in Congress a few years. He's very good looking, just very energetic and very young, and he's running unopposed for the Republican nomination. So he can already start sort of going at it with Mark Pryor, and they've already been going pretty much, you know, mano a mano. It's hard to tell. I mean, the polls, it's, of course, early in this race. The polls are pretty split. Most recent polls have Pryor maybe ahead by a couple of points. But for an incumbent senator, that is not at all comfortable. And there is millions of dollars pouring into that race. Landrieu, we're still trying to figure out who's going to be running against her. But, again, she's never polling much above 50, and that could be a really, really tough race for her.
Now, on the other hand, Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, looking a little bit vulnerable right now, at least in fundraising. What do you see in that race?
The McConnell race is interesting. The first hurdle he has to get over is a primary. It was expected this was going to be very difficult for him. He had a Tea Party challenger who has accused McConnell of being kind of an institutional Republican, go along with the Democrats, backing the, you know, big spending agenda. That candidate, a guy named Bevin, has not really caught fire, and it looks like McConnell will be able to win his primary easily, but he still has to spend money on it. And then waiting in the wings in the general election is a Democrat named Allison Lundergan Grimes, very well known in the state and a very close pal, it turns out, of the Clintons. She's already had Bill Clinton out there campaigning with her. She's bringing in a lot of money. She outraised McConnell in the first quarter of this year, $2.7 million for the first 3 months of the year. It's going to be a slugfest in the general election. And McConnell still, like I said, has to focus on also winning his primary.
Now, we talked about a couple of vulnerable Senate seats in the South for Democrats, Mark Pryor, Mary Landrieu. Can we generalize? Is this in general a problem that Democrats have in the South?
Yeah. I mean, if you look across the South, it's very hard for Democrats to win. I mean, if you look at the results of the presidential election, you'll see every time you see a map on the wall, it's red across the bottom all the way. And it is hard for Democrats to win those races. It's also particularly hard because, as we've talked about on this show, there is much less interest in a kind of moderate centrist, get along kind of Congress. There's much less interest in compromise. So the Democrats in the Republican areas, and for that matter, the Republicans in the Democratic areas, are running for their lives because nobody's really interested in having someone stand up and say, yeah, I'm from the other party, but, I can work well across the aisle. That doesn't get you very far.
So what do you make of this race, this midterm race that's shaping up, given what you just said about not being a race for centrists or moderates? What is the characteristic of this race in general going to be?
Well, I think there's two things that are going to be critical. The first is the Health Care Act. This is really going to be the year of the referendum on the Affordable Care Act. If Republicans are going to win, they're going to win in large measure because a lot of people, particularly a lot of white people, are going to come out and vote against what they call Obamacare. That is going to be the motivating factor that drives people to the polls. If the Democrats survive, it's going to be because, one, the economy is getting better and people are feeling more comfortable that the economy is getting better. And two, they're going to discover that this health care law has turned out to their advantage, that they like it better. It's not as bad as they thought it was going to be, that some of the horror stories didn't come true. I really do believe that, certainly all elections are local elections to some degree. And, Mary Landrieu wants to talk about flood insurance, not Obamacare. But this really is going to be the year that all the national money, all the national attention, and many of these races are going to be about, do you or do you not vote for the Health Care Act?
And Paul, in our last 30 seconds here, if Republicans are successful in taking the Senate, President Obama still in the office can veto bills. How do politics then actually change in Washington?
Well, you get more divided government, obviously. I think one of the critical things, obviously, is it will be very, very hard for Obama to get any of his agenda items voted on. Currently, he sort of relies on the Senate to bring up the things he cares about, even if the House is going to vote him down. If the Republicans take the Senate, he won't even have that. The budget battles will be fierce because he's got no champion on the Hill.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. Talk to you later. Bye.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to share his insights on Congress.
Former Wisconsin Senator Herb Kohl announced the sale of the Milwaukee Bucks pro basketball franchise to two hedge fund billionaires this afternoon. The proposed sale comes as the Bucks finish their season tonight with the NBA's worst record.
Fans looking for a bright spot for the Bucks during the last 9 months have focused some of their attention on a young forward from Greece. Chuck Kornbach has that story.
Formal practice is over at the Bucks training site in suburban Milwaukee, but 6-foot-10-inch forward Giannis Antetokounmpo is still on the court, working on his shooting, with Bucks assistant coach Josh Oppenheimer. The 19-year-old Antetokounmpo calls out as he and the coach launch three-pointers. That playfulness seems to be part of Antetokounmpo's personality. The Athens-born son of Nigerian immigrants has been in the U.S. less than a year. The Bucks made him their first-round draft choice last June, but he's been getting acclimated, and Antetokounmpo is hip enough about American ways to kid about his favorite foods.
Like burgers, McDonald's, Wendy's, KFC, all that. No, I'm joking. Yeah, just rice, chicken, you know, pastas.
His parents arrived from Greece a couple months ago to cook him more meals. Before that, Antetokounmpo made a few visits to Milwaukee restaurant Ma Fisher's. Second-generation Greeks own the diner, and Greece native Spilios Kalogriopoulos is the second-shift manager. Kalogriopoulos says the local Greek community of about 10,000 is very proud of Antetokounmpo. He says when he attends Bucks games, he often gives him a special cheer.
For example, if I am, you know, I am in the stands, and then he has the ball, and then I try to say, "Let's go, Giannis," or "Pame Giannis," do something in Greek.
There are other Greek players in the NBA, like Nick Kalathis and Kosta Koufos, but Kalogriopoulos says Antetokounmpo has the most promise. At the Bradley Center in Milwaukee, it can take some doing for fans to stay awake through the Bucks' many losses. But if you talk to boosters wearing Antetokounmpo jerseys, like Melissa Brown, their faces light up.
Well, number 34, Antetokounmpo. I can spell that as well, Antetokounmpo. But he's my favorite player. I love him. I think he's really going to go somewhere one day, and that's the jersey I wanted.
Antetokounmpo did play in the Rising Stars Challenge for rookies and sophomores at this year's NBA All-Star Weekend. Bucks coach Larry Drew says his young player has made a nice transition from playing in a second-tier league in Greece to the much more challenging NBA. But Drew does worry a little about all the hype.
He's been getting a lot of national attention, and the last thing you want is for him to get complacent. He's got to continue just to keep working his behind off and get better and better, because that is the only way he's going to get to that next level.
Drew says that next level is total consistency. Antetokounmpo says he's willing to work hard to improve, even for one of the NBA's worst teams.
It's a little bit hard, but what can we do? You know, we're just going to play hard. We're not going to give up. We're not going to give up yet. You know, we're going to play to the last game and finish strong.
The same day Antetokounmpo stayed late at practice, working on his three-pointers, he hit one late in a game against Orlando. It helped seal one of the Bucks' rare victories this year and earned a call from the PA announcer that the Bucks' hope is often repeated.
The Greek Freak for three!
I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
The debate over whether God exists has raged on for centuries, sometimes taking center stage in the public sphere, thanks to well-known atheists like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins.
But according to our next guest, Hitchens and Dawkins have actually misused science and mathematical concepts as they try to make the case that there is no God. In fact, he says science has yet to prove that there isn't a God.
Amir Axel joins us. He's a mathematician and research fellow in the history of science at Boston University. His new book is Why Science Does Not Disprove God. Amir, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Sure. Well, why did you feel compelled to take on this subject in a book? It's a hefty subject, I must say.
Well, two reasons, one of them objective and one personal. So first, the objective reason. I was up late one night and surfing the net. I was feeling a little sick, and I noticed that there's a new book 2 years ago by Lawrence Krauss saying that the universe came out of nothing, called The Universe from Nothing. And I've worked writing books about physics and mathematics for 20 years, and I knew from what I knew about physics, I also have degrees in that area, that it just isn't true. The universe doesn't come out of nothing. In fact, nothingness is really empty space, and empty space is immediately filled with forces and energy which can create particles through a mechanism discovered by Paul Dirac in 1928. And so you can't have a universe out of nothing. And it picked me. I bought the book, and I filled it with notations throughout. Everything didn't agree with what I knew. And then I was also at a conference in Mexico where Richard Dawkins was speaking. I was there with my daughter, and who was a young science student. She asked him an innocuous question, and he said, "You can believe in unicorns if you like," and walked away. And I thought, I should put that in a book too. So that's why I wrote the book.
Now, when you write it, though, are you trying to put forth any sort of religious perspective on your part?
That's a really good question and a tough one for me to answer, because I'm not a religious person. I find fault in the three major Western religions, at least. Not much that is supported by religion we see in everyday life. We certainly don't see a personal God. Statistically, we don't see God intervening in our lives, at least not often. So the God that I'm trying to defend in this book is the really Einstein's God, the God of nature, the God that created the laws of nature, the God that created the universe. And that doesn't have to be, it can be the God of any particular religion if you believe in one, or it can be a more abstract God. So that's really the way I view it.
Well, you say that in their quest to use science as a means of disproving the existence of God, people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens have actually misused science. Flesh that out a bit. How are they misusing science?
Well, there are several ways in which they do it. Richard Dawkins was the first. His book in 2006, The God Delusion, was the one that really started this whole debate. And if you go back, science won very big victories against religion in the 19th century. So you have evolution coming out in 1859, Darwin's theory. There are discoveries of Neanderthal bones all over Europe. There's Foucault's proof that the Earth rotates, which is the church really didn't believe that because of taking the scripture literally, the sun rises and so on. So all these were discoveries were and the young Earth theory, of course. Geology proved in the 19th century that the Earth is much, much older than a few thousand years. Now we know it's 4.5 billion years. So these are all victories of science against religion in the 19th century. But what people like Dawkins try to do is to stretch it further and to say that science in the 20th and the 21st centuries actually proves that there is no God. Now, there are holes in the theory, and Dawkins calls them the gaps, and calls the God of the gaps as something. If we don't understand something and there's a gap, it doesn't mean that God exists because of that. And it's a fair argument, but you could look at it another way and say that just because evolution starts somewhere and continues, and we know that we are the continuation through evolution of earlier hominids and so on, that doesn't mean that life originally emerged without some kind of a divine intervention. So there are holes in Dawkins' argument right away. Dawkins and other biologists can't prove that cells of living things emerged out of nothingness, from inanimate objects. That is something they can't prove. And what Dawkins tried to do in the last few years, and I've heard him talk about it at conferences where I spoke as well, is that the universe as a whole came out of nothing. And that's where Lawrence Krauss comes in, too, another cosmologist. The idea that God is unnecessary for the creation of the universe. And that's where most of the flaws in the arguments of these atheists lie. The universe does not rise out of nothing. The laws of physics, if nothing else, really have to come out of somewhere. And what pre-exists the universe, something called quantum foam, has to come from somewhere too. So it's really very wrong to say that the universe and life came about all by themselves. There's absolutely no scientific evidence for any of that.
And it sounds like you might be saying that Dawkins and others are inconsistently using the scientific process or not applying it equally against certain theories.
Absolutely. They're misapplying statistics, for one thing, and I get into it in the book to some detail, actually. And they are misapplying the scientific method altogether. I've written books about the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, for example, at CERN, and physicists there needed a statistical evidence to an unbelievable level of 5 or 6 sigma, which means the probability that any conclusion they come up with is wrong is 1 in 100 million or even smaller than that. So you really need strong proof when you're trying to make statistical and scientific conclusions. And these scientific atheists, so to speak, haven't come up with any such measures of error.
We're talking with Amir Excel. He is a research fellow at the History of Science in Boston University. His new book is Why Science Does Not Disprove God.
And we invite you to join the conversation. Has the public debate over the existence of God been off base? Do believers and non-believers alike need to be more skeptical of their own point of view? You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with science historian Amir Excel. He's the author of the book, Why Science Does Not Disprove God.
And we want to hear from you. In your opinion, has science sufficiently proven or disproven the existence of God? Are you a scientist who believes in God? We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's take a call from John in Appleton. Hi, John.
Hi, I was just calling. I wanted to know what the guest thinks about Russell's teapot, which basically states that the belief in God should be proven by the person making the claim, not the people attempting to address that claim.
Amir, are you familiar with that?
Well, that's a good question. He was a great philosopher. And, the question of the burden of proof. And obviously, is the glass half empty or half full? I mean, it's that kind of a question. So, sure, you could say, prove to me that God exists. And I certainly won't be able to do it. And maybe God is a matter of belief. But where I come in to this argument is by looking at the laws of nature and seeing that they're so complicated and intricate, you need many pages of very heavy mathematics to just describe the electron or to describe the Higgs mechanism that brought us the universe. The whole idea of how the universe came about with a fraction of a second after the Big Bang, the Higgs mechanism taking over and creating mass, and then there's this quark soup that just swirls around, and it has up and down quarks, and they all fall together just in the right way to create protons and neutrons with all their masses and their charges working out perfectly. This is called, in science, the fine-tuning argument. And our universe is so fine-tuned for life that Roger Penrose, a well-known scientist and mathematician in the UK, computed the probability of a universe arising, the universe we have, a universe that supports life, arising out of just by chance, as based on one parameter only, as 1/10^10^123. It's an immensely small number, and that's based on only one parameter. And then you think about the fact that if the dark energy that permeates space had been a tiny bit smaller or a tiny bit larger than what it is, the universe would have either collapsed on itself before life had the chance, before galaxies would have had the chance to arise, or blown up before that would have happened. So there's so many parameters. They're all fine-tuned to life. So to me, it says that there's something there. So do I have to prove the existence of God? I don't think I can, but I can say that I'm awed by what science teaches me. And I'm led to the belief that there's something there that we really don't understand. And we don't have, our science is not that advanced yet that we can claim perfect knowledge and through it maybe mastery of the universe.
Thanks for that call, John. Let's move over to Prairie du Chien. Joe is on the line. Joe, what's Hello. Your comment?
Yeah, when I was in college taking calculus, I failed miserably the first semester because I was applying algebra to it. And once I had, the best way to describe it, I had faith in the derivative. I did much better. And I think God is, as we call it, is best expressed in mathematics, because it seems to be have continuity across all regions of space. And I think that we also run into a stumbling block about trying to define God, because if he did create the universe, he's outside what we perceive. And it's the same thing as living in a home your entire life, never going outside and trying to determine what color it's been painted.
I'm with you completely in that. In fact, I have two chapters in the book about mathematics, and if you go the math way, it looks very different. The reason is that, of course, there are Gödel's proofs that you can't, any system has unknowable parts in it. You have to go outside the system to understand it. There are qualities of numbers that we can't grasp, prove, or disprove because we're within that system. Georg Cantor, who was the first mathematician to understand infinity, was a deeply religious man, and he brought us the first understanding of what the infinite really means. And infinity is obviously beyond us. So in a way, mathematicians, many of them tend to be religious, although they would probably cringe hearing me say that. But most mathematicians are Platonic in the sense that they believe that numbers and mathematical entities, such as a perfect square or a perfect circle, exist all on their own, regardless of the universe. And that belief is a belief in something that's higher and abstract and pre-exists the universe. So while it may not be a religion, it is a kind of a belief in the existence of things that go beyond us. And so mathematics is certainly the way to see the universe in a very different way.
That was a great question, Joe. We have Zeba on the line in West Allis. Zeba, what's your question?
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm calling in as a defender of Richard Dawkins. In the beginning of the gentleman's statement, he made some comments about Richard Dawkins. That is not true. Richard Dawkins has always stated firmly that he has no proof whatsoever. He cannot prove that God does not exist. So asserting that he said that is blatantly false. So it throws into suspicion every single thing he said afterwards.
I don't know if you made that out, Amir, but she's saying that Richard Dawkins has said that science doesn't have all the answers and there is no proof that God does not exist either.
Well, in all his talks, he speaks very strongly against religion. But although it is true that he hedges sometimes, in his book, he rated himself a 6 on a scale from 1 to 7 of belief versus disbelief. So he doesn't believe completely that God doesn't exist. He's only a 6 on a scale of 1 to 7. And I actually asked him about it when I met him at a conference. I asked him why he paid to place ads on buses in London saying, God probably doesn't exist, so just enjoy your life. And he told me that he thought it would be funny. So, you know, again, the word, I asked him why probably rather than completely. So, yes, the answer is he doesn't. I read his book very carefully, and, you know, the picture that comes out is that he doesn't believe in God, and he would like you, not the reader, not to believe in God. Whether he hedges or hides behind a probability or makes similar arguments, that's a different story. But he does. He certainly is a non-believer, and his book is aimed at that, you know, to tell people that.
Hmm. The debate over whether or not God exists has been going on for centuries, and given that we can't know exactly what God is or he or it would manifest him or itself in the universe, do you think we'll ever find the answer to that question, or will we still be having this debate a century from now?
Well, that's the very big question. What I think is that if someday we make contact with another civilization, while we may not know whether God exists or not, we'll learn about what other creatures came to in terms of, arrived at in terms of their beliefs, and maybe that would help solve part of the problem. On our own, it would be difficult. The problem is that we can't go beyond the Big Bang. So we can't really, as the caller mentioned, mathematics, we can't go outside our system or outside this house that is our universe. I don't think that signals from other universes can reach us or from before the universe was spawned. We can go back to a fraction of a second after the Big Bang, which is incredible. Mm. But we can't go behind the Big Bang to see what existed before that. So unless God makes... an appearance, we probably would never solve this conundrum.
Well, one question I want to ask you in our last minute here is, many people hold very deep personal beliefs about the existence of God, and yet somehow we failed to manage to have civil conversations about it, though I think we were successful today. What advice do you have for people who want to forge a sensible dialogue about this topic?
I think a dialogue, the time has come for it, for a dialogue, and when I see comments on about my book, I realize that this is a conversation that we should be having. So I'm glad that I managed in part to reopen that that discussion. Science has progressed tremendously over the 20th and 21st centuries, and it is the time to talk about these things.
Amir, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Amir Excel. He is author of Why Science Does Not Disprove God.